on in the ninth. Stanek swung one. It is thrilled on a line. Left field and gone! Adolis Garcia makes his statement. And the Rangers have their sights set on Game 7.
By Jove, Higgins, that was a glorious tee.
You have probably heard or read of the basic physics definition of a force. A basic definition says that, quote, a force is a push or a pull upon an object resulting from the object's interaction with another object. Whenever there is an interaction between two objects, there is a force upon each of the objects, end quote. Forces work by contact. A baseball player hits a ball with his bat. And forces work at a distance, such as the moon in its orbit around the Earth, or the Earth and its orbit around the Sun. But what exactly is a force? It is the name given to the invisible aspect of what we observe. We see the batter swing and send the ball some 400 or more feet over the left field fence for a home run, but the force behind it remains imperceptible to our observations. We can describe forces very precisely with mathematics, but mathematics did not cause the home run. They only describe the unseen forces at work.
A cup of tea.
Some physicists might tell you that that's all there is to it. There is nothing else to explain. Forces are just a brute fact of our universe. Now, no force or its associated mathematics ever told a physicist that forces are just brute facts which have no further need of explaining. Consider that physics presently tells us that there are four known fundamental forces in the universe: the weak nuclear force, which is responsible for holding subatomic particles known as quarks together. Quarks are what make up protons and neutrons in the nucleus of an atom. The strong nuclear force is what holds the protons and neutrons together in the nucleus of an atom. There is the electromagnetic force, which holds electrons in place around the protons and neutrons. Then there is gravity, which is what holds the universe together, but it is, ironically, the weakest of the four forces. No one has yet to figure out how gravity fits together with the other three forces. The atom is a pretty remarkable structure, all things considered. It is the building block of anything with stuff in it, from stars to planets and people and porcupines and everything in between. If you can touch, taste, smell, or see it, it has atoms. Much of what we know about the atom today has come about from observations and experiments conducted in the last 100 years or so. But why the atom at all? Why these strange particles? Why are they so versatile? And what might it all mean? These are, of course, philosophical questions that physics cannot answer by strict scientific or empirical means. Our guest this week and next on The Profile, friend of Watchman Fellowship and professor of philosophy at Southern Evangelical Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina, Dr. Richard G. Howe, believes that philosophy comes from our observation of the physical world. The big questions, like why is there something rather than nothing, why the universe, why am I here, all come about from a rich ancient tradition of contemplating the universe and all it contains. While scientists certainly have many personal philosophical beliefs about the nature of the atom and what the universe is all about, science as a formal discipline can neither prove nor disprove God's existence. Why is that? As Dr. Howe notes in his article, Has Science Refuted Miracles and the Supernatural?, in The Comprehensive Guide to Science and Faith, Exploring the Ultimate Questions About Life and the Cosmos, quote, because of the narrow limits of the methods, tools, and protocols of science, it is incapable of weighing in on the subject. By analogy, the fact that a metal detector cannot notice a seashell composed as they are of calcium carbonate is not an argument against the existence of seashells. Precisely because science, as science, has aligned itself with certain assumptions about what the nature of things must be, science cannot treat things that fall outside of its methods." End quote. While a scientist certainly can have his or her own personal beliefs and opinions about God's existence and his relationship to the cosmos, those beliefs are not finally established by the formalized practice of science itself. But because of the epistemic weight our culture gives to science today, we tend to uncritically accept the non-scientific philosophical opinions and observations scientists make about God and the cosmos as having been established by science. For those of you who are more philosophically minded, Dr. Howe is an Aristotelian in his philosophical outlook. And whether you might agree with him or not about that, one cannot deny the efficacy of Howe's winsome and often humorous approach to making philosophy understandable for the rest of us.
I told my students once, I tried to do a presentation on the attributes of God in balloon animals. I said, but omnipresence, so I just took it out on me. That was a hard one there.
From physics to biblical hermeneutics, Dr. Howe and I have a fun and lively chat about the importance of philosophical discourse and its relationship to sound Christian theology. As we jump into part one, I ask Richard for a basic definition of philosophy. Here is Dr. Richard G. Howe.
Yes, in the philosophy class that I teach at Southern Evangelical Seminary, we try to start out by defining what it is. And then we discover that a lot of times it's easier, having gotten a little bit of philosophy under our belt, to look backwards over what we've been doing and go, that's kind of what we mean by philosophy. But we do have to start somewhere. So the word philosophy maybe is familiar to many people in terms of its origin. It just comes from two Greek words, the Greek word for love and the Greek word for wisdom. And in the ancient times, philosophy was really a word used for learners, for what we might call today scholars, because of the distinction between now what's referred to as philosophy and other disciplines on a university campus, for example, is relatively recent demarcation, maybe modern since the 16th century onward, where that really got segmented out. So that while in the ancient Greek world, a person like an Aristotle would be talking about botany or physics as much as he's talking about epistemology and metaphysics. Today's university campus, if you're in the physics department, you can't even see where the philosophy department is from where they're standing. They're so diverse. But a little bit more practical kind of way is philosophy is trying to give critical and rational answers to life's most important questions. So by critical, we mean not a negative sense of being looking down on something, you're criticizing it, but using the powers of critique, where we're critiquing the question and what it's trying to, what kind of answer it's seeking. So we want to be critical as opposed to like saying being naive or just believe everything you hear. So the philosopher wants to be a little bit more, hey, we need to examine what is being claimed, whether it's a claim about morality, public issues, or God, or whatever. And then the role that reason will play as opposed to emotions. Emotions are fine. We're emotional beings as humans. But we don't want emotions to run ahead of the role of reason to set boundaries of what follows logically from a given premise, for example. So we want to be critical in the sense of looking more in depth at issues, and we want to be rational in the sense of using the canons of logic and reason and evidence. You know, that's even more critical in today's world, as more and more we're discovering that people are beginning to abandon the canons of logic, evidence, reason as a platform of public discourse. Now, violence or standing up and screaming while somebody disagrees with you, that's the recourse that a lot of people are referring to. So we've got to be able to stick to our guns. And of course, there's more to say about specific contours of philosophy I'm sure we'll get into as we go along.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned, Richard, the idea of the cultural discourse. of the time. And it's the theologian John Frame. I'm fond of a lot of his thinking, but he brings up something in his huge tome, The History of Western Philosophy and Theology, that I think is critical or is crucial. And it's something that even I think Christians, we have maybe, I'd say, forgotten, or we're just maybe not aware of. But it seems, though, Richard, that we're starting in the kind of conversations that you just mentioned, there's not a patient cultivation of wisdom or a love of wisdom. They're maybe not even aware of the kind of tradition that is that is behind it. And so in some sense, it seems like part of the struggle of the church today would be that it's taking its cultural cues in terms of having these conversations from the culture rather than from the richness of our own philosophical and theological tradition. It seems like we ought to begin as Christians in the church to recapture the rich discourse that exists between philosophy, theology, reason, and logic. Do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think sometimes people's animus to philosophy, they don't realize exactly what they're giving up by that regard. You know, when I was a graduate student in philosophy at the University of Mississippi, affectionately known as Ole Miss, and this was the old days before the internet, where you could register for classes in the privacy of your own room and such. Back in the old days, the caveman days, it took an all-day Saturday to register for classes. You queue up at these kiosks with a table, and the person goes through a set of cards to find out whether biology at 8 o'clock on Monday still has, you know, opening. So invariably, yeah, that leads to everybody standing in these long queues all day long, and you get in these cliche conversations. And I discovered there's nothing like telling somebody you're working on a graduate degree in philosophy to really get the conversation going. But what I noticed is over the years, when you tell someone in whatever context that somehow you're a philosopher or you're studying philosophy or you're reading a book on philosophy, whatever the subject comes up, I ran into at least three kinds of reactions, because some people were, puzzled as to what it is. What do you do with a philosophy degree? That was usually a common. What are you going to do with that? Which I wished I had thought about it at the time. If someone had ever, if I said, well, what are you majoring in? Well, I'm in pre-med. I wish I had the presence of mind to think, well, what are you going to do with that? Just to throw that back. What are you going to do with a pre-med degree? You know. So some people were, you know, what do you do with philosophy? What is its practical? How do you get a job with it? But then some were a little bit more suspicious, especially in the Christian context. When my Christian friends find out, well, you know, I was doing a graduate degree, they're like, I'm not really sure how that's going to help you as a Christian. So there was a little bit of suspicion. Not sure how that fits in. And then even worse, some was an outright animus, in the sense that, well, philosophy's not an answer to anything. It's always the problem. And that's what we're having to fight. That was the reaction I would run into. So I thought, I'm going to have to try to help my fellow Christians see that, first of all, there's an inevitability to philosophical issues that we encounter as doing Bible study and theology. You already alluded to it in our conversations earlier. But then there's a need for it at some point, which I try to argue as in your face as that kind of claim is. There's actually, I think, an inevitability and a need for philosophical thinking in some respects to just do the theology that all of us as Christians hopefully cherish and want to do.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this animus from the Christian camp in-house. I hear a lot of people talking about, or they will cite, the Apostle Paul in Colossians, the second chapter, the 8th verse. See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elemental spirits of the world, and not according to Christ. So any whiff of Plato or Aristotle embedded in our theology, whether it's Augustine or any of the church fathers who are borrowing from their favorite philosophers, that this is where the problem begins. You syncretistic, Greek-loving idolaters, why are you incorporating this human-centered nonsense into our rich theological tradition? We just need the Bible. We don't need philosophy and all of its metaphysics. Richard, I'm sure you've heard that objection many times. How do you address the objection coming from Paul's
First question I think we have to confront is Paul there in Colossians 2 talking about philosophy there, does he mean the same thing that we mean by that word today? You know, Plato, Aristotle, or for that matter, you know, Plantiga, whomever you want to name, good or bad, right? So that's the first question. So let's just assume, for the sake of the argument, that that is what he's talking about. And I think at the very least, when he's warning us about philosophy and not to be deceived by it, I loved what C.S. Lewis says in this regard. He said, good philosophy must exist if for no other reason than bad philosophy needs to be answered. So in other words, there are philosophical, what we would identify as philosophical, if we looked at them deeply enough, there are philosophical assumptions or outright claims that are being made in opposition to the claims of Christ that we have to understand enough to know how to respond to. And if the claim is philosophical, whatever that means, and if the means by which we respond to it is an appeal to some of the categories and methods and tools of philosophy, whatever that is, then that means inevitably somebody's got to be doing the philosophy, just like someone would have to do a natural science if they were trying to argue that we know that Adam and Eve couldn't have really existed because of what Darwin has taught us about evolution. It would take someone trained in the natural sciences to counter that. So it's a very minimal. In fact, I love even earlier than Lewis, much earlier when Thomas Aquinas kind of making the same point. He said, because the teacher of sacred scripture must at times oppose the philosophers, he must at times make use of philosophy. Never again, that ends up looking like. So I think at a very minimal sense, as Norman Geiser argues in his address 1998 to the Evangelical Theological Society when he was president, he said, when Paul tells us to beware of philosophy, he said, you can't beware of philosophy unless you be aware of philosophy. But again, whatever we end up deciding what that looks like. So there's this negative kind of obligation. We've got to know enough about it to know what it is that we're trying to avoid being deceived by. But I think even more, I think that's not even, Paul's not even talking, I don't think, in Colossians 2 about philosophy like epistemology or metaphysics. I think, and I mean, people would have to do their own research and see what they think, but I think the Greek could be rendered to say, be not deceived by the philosophy, which is vain deceit. That he's speaking of one particular kind of philosophy that was scandalizing or sabotaging the lives of the Colossians. In fact, if one goes on to read in chapter 2, the rest of that chapter, so to speak, I often ask audiences that even if they're familiar with that verse, I'd say, do you know what the context is? What does he go on to really warn the Colossians about? And what he's warning them about in context is this insidious form of legalism where touch not, taste not, handle not, that has an appearance of religiosity but is of no use against the indulgences of the flesh. So there was this nascent form of Gnosticism that was beginning to plague the Colossians. And I think that's what he had in mind. Now, that still doesn't justify our use of philosophy. Just even if our opponent said, okay, so maybe Paul's not condemning philosophy like you shouldn't read Aristotle. Maybe he's not saying that. Still shouldn't be deceived by Aristotle or whatever. Okay, that's fair. I still have to answer that argument. But I think at least as far as the biblical case, because I know people like John MacArthur, for example, make a lot out of this verse. He did a sermon back in 1978, the MP3 of which is on his website. And then he revisited it not too many years ago in a blog entry where he juxtaposes philosophy and Christ, appealing to Colossians 2:8. So you have to deal with that exegetical concern before we can move on to go, okay, now what is the case? What is it to do philosophy? And what is the case? How does theology actually needed, if indeed it does?
I think, yeah, and you make an excellent point there, several excellent points, but I think the one that settled it for me was recognizing what you had said in the Greek, the philosophy of empty deceit, that mm-hmm. is, and the underlying thing is, according to human tradition. So this would be something like Parmenides, man is the measure of all things. So a philosophy yeah. that would be beginning and ending with man, the creation of man's own mind, his own system, his own paradigms, Frame argues that that a lot of Western philosophy is a history of anti-theistic thinking, and that's what sort of turns people off in the Christian realm to philosophy in general, because it seems so polemically opposed to Christianity. And especially in apologetics, I've run into in the last several years, especially being at Watchmen, Richard, the thoughtful atheist. We've had Graham Oppie, who's probably one of the world's leading atheist philosophers, on the Atheist and Christian Book Club twice now. Very, very genteel, wonderful, kind guy. He's a former Christian, but he is revered by, you know, more thoughtful skeptics about, you know, being the philosopher. Even Bill Craig has said something about his adroit philosophical skills and knowledge. That here in Graham Oppie are some ideas and philosophical ideas that seem to be reasonable and rational, that can systematically construct a worldview. So there's this realm of philosophy that I've encountered that is highly technical. If you go in, and I've kind of looked at some of the other technical atheist philosophers of the time, Bertrand Russell comes to mind, but there's several others whose names I can't bring to mind. But there's a whole school of modern atheist philosophical thought that is deliberately opposed to Sobel comes to mind. I can't think of any others at the moment. But this idea that if we, and we're ignorant of this philosophy, we and it seems, if you're sitting on the fence of Christian theism, if you're not sure Christianity, God exists or whatever, and along comes a thoughtful, rational philosopher with these ideas, then whoosh, they're taken up by the premises and the conclusions of these naturalistic ideas. But philosophy for the Christian, the helpfulness for me is to see the distinctiveness between a worldview that tries to explain why the cosmos is the way it is, why it's even here, why it's arranged like it is. All of these questions, and some of the oldest philosophical arguments are cosmological in nature. All of these arguments are really, philosophy is really trying to make sense, the best sense of the world. And really what's been helpful for me is a systematic defense of good philosophy shows the problems with atheist philosophy. The premises are often rooted in materialism. And so I was wondering if you could maybe unpack some of the basic faulty, your top five, Richard's top five arguments against certain popular atheistic philosophical premises that can be useful for our audience that might hear. You could do it in 5 minutes. That'd be great, too.
That's right. Yeah. What language do you want me to do it in? You do it in Swahili while I'm at it.
Can you do it in Latin? And
I'll do balloon animals. How about that?
Hey, there's something for defend. Richard Howen, the philosophy of how to convey philosophy with balloon animals. That would be great.
That's right. Yeah. I told my students once, I tried to do a presentation on the attributes of God and balloon animals. I said, but omnipresence. So I just took it out on me. That was a hard one.
Well, you could say, that I can't imagine how you do that in a balloon, except maybe the universe.
That's right. The omnipresent balloon was a little difficult.
For practical purposes, because I know if our listeners haven't checked out by now, because this is philosophy, but what are some the big ones and their problems that can be simple? There's no simple philosophical argument, but yeah. What are the big atheistic philosophical arguments, and how can we kind of unpack them?
So one of the values I think a person can gain by studying philosophy and reading both helpful and enemies at the same time in the history of human thought is developing skills of critique. We mentioned at the beginning that it's a rational critique, right? So we want to be able to critique. But one of the things that a skillful critique can hopefully expose, if you will, make manifest, are assumptions upon which various arguments are resting that aren't made explicit necessarily. So you find this a lot in the marketplace where, for example, one might try to share the gospel and the person they're talking to, you mentioned, for example, a materialist, has this background assumption that all things in reality ultimately are just variations on basic material categories. But often that's not necessarily an explicit you know, plant a flag and I'm going to argue from my materialism. It's just a background assumption that maybe someone just absorbed osmotically from their culture. And they don't, may not even know that they're operating this way. So they're looking for God. They're going to examine our arguments. But they're like someone on the beach with a metal detector looking for seashells. And the problem is, of course, seashells are not made out of metal. They're made out of calcium carbonate. So it doesn't matter how powerful a metal detector he has, if his very method of examining the evidence has already excluded some of the evidence, then he's never going to be able to see the evidence. And I'm not suggesting it's always with an animus in mind and with a you know, ulterior motive. They may not know that they have all they have is a metal detector, and they may be honestly in their own mind looking for the seashell. So somebody's got to come along and go, wait a minute, seashells aren't made of metal, so your metal detector is completely useless here. So the parallel is then, if someone is thinking that we have to cash out all elements of every argument ultimately along the categories of this mechanistic contemporary materialistic view where everything is are made of inert particles acted upon by various consciousless forces, gravity or whatever, and that's it, that how it has to be reduced to that, you go, well, that's just arbitrary. Why does it have to be reduced to that? What is your argument that that has to be the case? And so the philosopher comes along to try to disabuse them of their commitment to that and say, can we open up? So what I've discovered too is when it comes in the contemporary context of arguing, especially arguing the existence of God, you see really two kind of broad categories. I'm sure there are different ways you could divide the arguments, but one way to divide the arguments that I think can be helpful are those arguments that more or less use the method of appeal to the best explanation or argument to the best explanation.
Okay, just real quick clarification, both for me and our listeners here, but just kind of making sure I caught what you were saying. So when you get into discussions about God or philosophy, in a sense that everybody has, whether examined or unexamined, philosophy helps to peel back those non-tangibles that we just assume, but maybe we aren't aware of the fact that we're assuming them. So there's a lot of unseen, intangible, what we call tacit variables in our thinking that are not always readily available to the senses, and philosophy helps us get to the core of those ideas, right? That's
absolutely
okay. That's kind of a summary of what you just said. Okay, perfect.
That's right.
Okay,
and so it helps us do that. And by the way, as I think I kind of said this, that one of the healthy things to do for especially a person who's interested in the scholarship, one of the ways to get one's own assumptions that might be sabotaging the way they think of a problem as a Christian even is reading a material that disagrees with your point of view.
Yes, absolutely.
Because if I'm talking to somebody and they already grant all my conclusions, and I can get away with a bad argument, then they probably won't notice because they already agree with my conclusion.
Right.
Sort of a syndrome among seminary students if they're not careful.
Yes.
We're all on the same page. But there's no substitute. If a person wants to expand their understanding of these things, it's not everybody's calling, but I'm saying if someone wants to do that, likely your audience would, because that's why they're already familiar with Watchman Fellowship in the first place, that they want to understand the reasons and stuff. So, you know, reading Jehovah's Witness material would be the best way to hone your arguments, because then they're the ones that are going to maybe help you see where you're missing the boat, got the
right
facts wrong, or got
right
the whatever.
To your point there, I just wrote an article on my blog about this, what I learned from reading Mormon theology.
Oh, wow.
Of course, there's all kinds of polemical rebuttals that you can throw at Mormon theology, but my point wasn't that. It was much more of like, what I saw that I had the falsehoods in my mind. Now, I would tell you on paper that they were, we don't earn our salvation and, you know, we can have assurance of salvation. And I could tell you all this, but as I'm reading Mormon theology, I'm confronted really with what I practice, quoting what I would call the cult of my own heart. Just kind of exposing here I was seeing the fallacious reasoning in my own mind as codified scripture within the LDS tradition. Now, I could tell you that these negative thoughts were not theologically sound, but God kept, if he's going to send me to the LDS, he's going to have to confront the fact that I am kind of like this and this and this way. But and we do the Atheist and Christian Book Club, and I've been reading a lot of quote-unquote opposition literature, as you talk about. But yeah. but both of those combined, Richard, has been very helpful for me to solidify the cumulative case argument, the premises that Christianity is true and is the best worldview. I've seeing this Christianity through the lens of other worldviews is tremendously helpful.
Now, have you found that it also gives you more credibility when you're talking to a Latter-day Saint that you've already read LeBron Richards or whomever, and they're like, oh, wow, yeah, I've read that.
Yeah.
I think that helps us in our credibility.
It does, and I think especially with conversations with atheists who one of their favorite arguments is that Christians aren't familiar with stuff outside their own tradition. And a lot of us do suffer from that bubble mentality, never being exposed to anything else on the other side. But I think that that has richly cultivated a trust and a link to God that had I not had this, it may have been weakened by just me assuming and believing like everybody else. And so that's true. So continue. I didn't mean to interrupt your thought.
No, not at all. The reason I bring this distinction up that I'm cataloging two different kinds of the arguments that we use in our apologetics is that it allows me in a broader context to lobby for the need for philosophy. But one of those categories into which I think some of our arguments, particularly arguments about God's existence, falls are arguments that are appealing to the best explanation. We've got a set of data, and we want to go, what best explains that data of various hypotheses? So I think you find this very, very often in a lot of the appeals to the natural sciences as a means of showing how there's a fingerprint of God in the fine-tuning of the universe, for example, or in the biological complexity, irreducible complexity, or information theory, or things like that. So you go, you've got this phenomena out there that we're examining in the physical world, which itself is, to a large extent, relatively uncontroversial. There may be a little quarrel here and there about how fine-tuned the universe actually exhibits or whatever. But I say, by and large, it seems to me, as a non-scientist, it seems to be the sort of standard view of various things in the physical world. So then we step back and go, what's the best explanation for that? And very often, the best explanation is going to end up being some version of the conclusion that it looks like there is an intelligence or a mind, you will, behind it all, which right then knocks the scaffolding out of this materialist worldview. Because there's something conscious about reality that explains why the universe would be the way that it is. Now, whether that conscious is the universe itself, as the pantheists would say, or relates to the universe the way the soul relates to a body, the way the panentheists would say, or whether it's there are a bunch of those consciousness, the way the polytheists are, those are all fair questions downstream. But if you get them at least that far, you're already in the right corridor to then narrow the hallway down to the monotheism of the Judeo-Christian tradition.
Throw in a caveat there at the end.
Yes, please.
The historical tradition of philosophy is in our court with cosmological arguments. Not that Plato and Aristotle and everybody that followed was exactly a pristine theist in any sense of the word, but in early in Greek philosophy and Arabic philosophy, well, even in pantheistic or paganistic philosophy, you have this sense of a consciousness, intelligence, a prime mover, an essential, eternal something or other, a being like a god or God. That is early on in these arguments for the cosmos. It's, Democritus and the atoms in the void. This comes later in the tradition, but it is the atomist, determinist, materialist, is that an aberrant offshoot of early Greek thought, Richard, or do we have a dominant view in the early days of philosophy that the...
I, as far as I can see, there's not so much a dominant view. There was a lot of diversity, I should say. Now, there's some dominance in the sense of downstream or throughout history, who ends up having, whose shadow falls the longest. as Alfred North Whitehead said in the 20th century, all of philosophy is but footnotes to Plato, for example. And so certainly Plato and Aristotle's shadow falls very, very far, even till today, whereas today people aren't probably too worried about Heraclitus a whole lot. But even still, you can see little vestiges of some of their thinking. So there's probably not a such thing as, quote, Greek thought, as if it was some monolith. It's more like you were describing something as disparate as an Aristotle or Plato on the one hand and Democritus on the other, or the classical juxtaposition is Heraclitus and Parmenides. Everything changes, nothing changes. You know, everything's pluralistic, but there's only one thing. You know, that's about as extreme on the bookends that you could get. But it does serve to illustrate this other class of kind of arguments, not opposition to, but in distinction to the argument to the best explanation. And these are arguments that are the demonstrations based on fundamental philosophical truths, the metaphysics, if you will, that you try to show, given the nature of reality as a reasonable mind can display, given those fundamental categories, we can show you that God exists.
I'm sorry to keep bumping in. I'm just
no, not at all.
Doing it for clarity's sake. Just real quick, unpack, define what metaphysics is. We drop that word a lot, but what are we talking about when we're talking about metaphysics?
Yeah. So today, metaphysics basically deals with some of the fundamental questions, categories about ultimate reality, or about the basic questions about reality. So when we start talking about things like causality, things happen, events happen by virtue of causes. The question about, well, what is causality and what are susceptible to being caused? Are there different kinds of causes? Those are questions that the metaphysics addresses. Or if we start talking about questions about permanence and change, what is it about an acorn over the course of years as it becomes an oak tree? Is there something that remains the same throughout all those changes? And then if so, what is that? And is there something that is sort of the basis where the changes occur in that sameness? Whatever those are there sameness, not? If it is, what is it? Are there changes or not? If there are changes, what are all of those kind of questions? Are there under the penumbra of metaphysics? The word just basically means after the physics. And it likely arose out of the fact that, well, Aristotle wrote a book called Physics, and then he wrote another treatise. And when it was collected by his disciples and put into a corpus, the other treatise came after the physics.
Gotcha.
So it became known as the metaphysics.
All right.
But ironically, and perhaps providentially, the subject matter are things dealing with beyond the physics, the things that underlie just the mere physical, is what Aristotle was talking about. And that's kind of how the term, I think, historically got attached to that subject matter.
Gotcha. So like Plato's realm of the ideal would be metaphysics.
Absolutely. It's meta, yeah. Because it's beyond. Unfortunately, in 20th and now 21st century America, the term metaphysics has been co-opted by the New Age movement. So now you go into a bookstore and the metaphysics section has Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance,
right,
and Deepak Chopra and all this nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, well, that's not legitimate metaphysics as a philosophical thing. So one has to be careful, and as I just wasn't. One has to be careful when they use the term that people understand what they mean and don't mean the sort of popular occult usage of the term, because it's handy, because it's also beyond the physics, if
right.
you go beyond the physics.
Right. It's like New Agers are trying to co-opt quantum reality. You just throw that word quantum around and
absolutely
it sounds
deep. Christoph Kopra, for example,
right
you know,
and and here is where responsible philosophy just helps to sort of doink all that nonsense on its head, where we're throwing around terms borrowed from academia and they mean something entirely different. This is like Mormonism and evangelical Christianity, where we all,
and you can't get more philosophical terminology than doink.
Doink, that's like balloon animals, you know. You just try to break
exactly.
it down to the most necessary and essential vocabulary and meaning that you can possibly find.
Just don't joint the balloons.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So I appreciate you emphasizing my my philosophical erudition with doink.
There you go.
I appreciate that. But we're talking about, so for an example of this metaphysics, so the early Greek metaphysics was, they were asking questions like, Thales, everything is water. Anaximenes, mm-hmm. everything is air. Anaxagoras, mm-hmm. Anaxagoras, something, everything is indefinite, or there is something indefinite about the universe. Heraclitus is fire. I always used to say is that Heraclitus? Is that the way you say that?
Heraclitus. That's Heraclitus. The way I've said it.
Okay.
Yes.
Everything is fire. Pythagoras is everything is number. These were metaphysical ideas about what the whole of the universe was. The cosmos was all this. The cosmos was all that. And so, mm-hmm. so even in talking about the cosmos, what is it? That what is it question is not something like in astronomy, cosmology, and physics, they can talk all day long about the constituent materiality of the world, the physical particles and the energy and the matter, and they're really good at all that stuff. But what NASA and no other physicist that I've ever read has ever been able to do is to tell us what the universe actually is. And it seems to be, if you'd ask that question, they would say it's just the material arrangement of things. But that's a philosophical, metaphysical question, really.
Absolutely.
It's not a physics or cosmology question. And astronomers and cosmologists don't have the monopoly on defining what the cosmos is, because quite frankly, as much as I widely read on this topic, no one has yet to define what the cosmos actually is. And that is an example of what we're talking about here with metaphysics.
It reminds me of a hilarious story R.C. Sproul told, where he's walking across the campus with a physics professor, and he's critical, says, you know, you theologians, you talk about God, and you can't even define that, blah, blah, blah. Kind of like what you're talking about, being able to define these things. And Sproul asked him, he said, so you physicists always traffic in the category of energy. So what is energy? And the physicist said, well, energy is the ability to do work. And he said, I don't want a functional definition. That's what it does. But what is it?
Right.
He said, well, it's EMC squared. E equals MC squared. He says, I don't want its mathematical equivalence. I want to know what it is. And he just kept pressing him until he got the physicist to say, well, I mean, there's sort of this bottom below which I guess he couldn't go because
right.
he didn't know how to reduce it to anything.
Richard, that is absolutely the problem with I think, not only the field of science, but in all of modern academia, the big question of what all this is, if you ask any philosopher or physicist or astronomer or biologist, everything is just or only nothing buttery, as I heard one person call it, a nothing but the physical constituents and arrangement of subatomic particles. The answer to the biggest questions about why we're here and where we're going, it seems to rest in how big we can build our colliders and our detectors, and we're all looking for the elusive physical particle that will hopefully explain everything. But it seems, Richard, that exchange is a perfect example, I think, of where we're sort of duped, even as Christians, to think that, oh, a scientist told me what is a heart or a liver? Well, it's just this matter. What is energy? Well, it's just this equation. But that's not ultimately the answer. That's what it does. That's its mathematical relationship, but that's not what it is. And going back to Lewis, I don't know if you've read through the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, his Chronicles of Narnia. There's a wonderful exchange where Eustace Scrub is the human being that comes into Narnia with the children, and he doesn't like it, doesn't believe it, but he ends up on this island talking to a retired star. And there's this exchange where Eustace says, in our world, a star is just a huge ball of flaming gas. And the retired star wisely says, that is not what a star is, only what it is made of. And that, I think, is the problem. And this is where good philosophy can come in. How can we can catch the assumption by, in an answer that we give, we can catch the philosophical connotations of what we're being told. And ask those why questions, like Socrates did, if we have a particular
absolutely
taste for hemlock, as long as we don't mind the hemlock, right?
That's why I'll skip the hemlock.